Hello, this is Rob Pearman. We began our examination of three of the world's major religions by bringing together three local faith leaders. Our aim was to start the series by looking at some of the key differences between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and some of the aspects of belief which they have in common. Today we start our sequence of individual discussions with each of these faith leaders. We'll move in turn through the three, and we'll do so chronologically. And so we begin today with Judaism and with Rabbi Raphael Kaiserbluth, who is Rabbi of the Masorti Synagogue in St. Albans. Welcome to our studio. You're going to take us through six sessions, if you like, on Judaism, and you've selected those. And you want to start with the covenant?
A covenant, indeed. It is the basis, the foundation of our relationship with God. And many people foresee or picture relationship with a king and his people, but the idea that we have with in Judaism is that it's much more of a two-way relationship. And the best analogy probably I can come up with is that between a married couple, between a husband and a wife. That is the basis, the model, if you will, of the relationship in Judaism between God and his people.
Okay, well, just help us term. The term covenant,
yes,
is not one that we use every day.
It is not.
So what does it actually mean?
What does it mean is a unique bond of a relationship wherein it is a two-way relationship. When you create a marriage, in a way, you are specifying responsibilities and obligations that the husband has towards the wife and the wife has towards the husband. When you are talking about a covenant in property ownership, for example, it is not just a contract that the landlord will give a space to rent for the tenant and they pay rent. It is also a covenant that they will provide upkeep and repair and that sort of idea. And it is indicative, I think, when you look at the relationship with the Israelites and God in the Bible, when there is inevitably those moments where the Israelites mess up, for lack of a better term, the language, the words in the literature that it uses is that indicative of infidelity. And it is that powerful model to show that it is not simply God is here telling us what to do and that's the end of the story. It is God telling us these are expectations and your obligations, but God also has expectations and responsibilities to fulfill.
Okay, it's still quite a difficult concept, though, isn't it?
It is.
You're shifting from a sort of a naive, simplistic view of the all-powerful God who tells everybody what to do into something you described as a marriage, and a marriage is between equals. Does a Jew believe that he's equal to God?
In so much as they are equal parts of the relationship, not in that they are equal in terms of power, omniscience, omnipotent, not in that sense. And it's a difficult, sometimes abstract concept to understand, but it is also a powerful understanding because if you look at the different times that we have covenants enumerated in the Bible, it is you have to ask the question, why does God need to do this? God is God. God can simply exist. But the model there is that, no, God needs us just as much as we need God. We are God's people to fulfill the commandments and the obligations. But why? As it says several times in the Bible, we are to be holy. We are a holy people. Why? Because God is holy. We want to emulate God. But God also promises these things, protection, descendants, our legacy, provided we are following in the footsteps and the terms that God has laid out. So the covenant, the Bible is sometimes called the Brit, simply the covenant. You have the covenant between God and Abraham and is repeated between Isaac and then in Jacob and then following later on with Moses. But it's not really with Moses at that point. It is with the entire people. And there's a beautiful metaphor, one of the rabbinic stories that we're taught at Mount Sinai, that revelation. There's two things that are told that happened there. One is the giving of the Ten Commandments or the Ten Utterances, depending on how you translate it. But it's also this idea that the covenant is formalized. And the Midrash, the rabbinic story, states that it's actually a wedding. That Mount Sinai is the wedding canopy, Moses is the officiant, and the wedding contract is the Bible, the Ten Commandments. And God and the Israelites are consummating and formalizing their relationship at that point. Because what is the point of being in a relationship if there are no expectations from either side? Because otherwise it becomes dominated only by one, which they had just been in slavery in Egypt. So the objective is, the point that they're emphasizing is, we are people, yes, we are in service to God. There's no question about that. But God also is there to provide for and protect and defend us. And if we live in that relationship full of obligations and responsibilities on both sides, it is a much more powerful, fulfilling, enduring relationship versus one that is one-sided, dominated by one party.
Has that always been the Jewish belief, or is that something that has developed through learning and teaching and studying the text?
That is fairly clearly stated out in the Bible and continues on. Now, there are some ebbs and flows, and it's just like any other relationship. To say that it's equal is not correct. Relationships are not equal, nor should they be. They're balanced. That means over time, needs and desires will be evened out. But at any given time, they might not be equal. And in an interesting way, when I do some marriage counseling, that's exactly what I try and tell people. There are some times where one spouse will need more attention, and sometimes some will others. But the idea is still, ask yourself, why does God need this? And you look at that first covenant between Abraham and God. Wouldn't it be sufficient? God could just sit after creating the world, don't need to do anything else. God doesn't necessarily, you would think, need company. God doesn't need to interact with us. But it seems to be stating another reason. And I think that's part of the question behind the Bible, is trying to explain why we're here. What is our purpose? What is our function on this planet? It's not simply a cosmic accident that we're here. We're here for a very specific reason, and that is, I think, to bring holiness into this world, to bring that closeness and togetherness with God. And you do that in a relationship with expectations and boundaries set up. In any relationship, whether it be a business relationship, a marriage relationship, or a social relationship, there are always terms, whether they're written down or not. There are expectations of behavior, there are expectations of reciprocity, and there's expectations of future development. And this covenant spells those things out.
You talk about Abraham and the covenant mm-hmm. being, first of all, with Abraham. What is the nature of that? I mean, is that where the chosen people come from? Is that God chose a particular group?
So the idea there, and you can look at it in the name, that Abraham is the first Hebrew, as we say in our tradition. And if you look at the word Hebrew in Hebrew, as it were, it's Ivri. And if you look at the root of that, Ever or Avar means the man or the person from across or over there. Now, literally, that means from across the river, whether it be the Jordan River or the Euphrates River. It's not clear which river they're talking about, but it seems to be much more than simply a geographic definition. It is, in essence, the man who stood alone, apart from everybody else. He is that first person to espouse this idea of monotheism. He is the first person to deal with a different kind of morality. And there's lots of rabbinic stories that are not in the text, but talk about why Abraham was picked over everybody else and why the people who descended from Abraham were picked. Now, there's an erroneous idea that the people picked and descended from Abraham are better than everybody else, and it's simply not the case. That's not supported in the text, but I suppose you can read and find whatever you'd like in the text. But really the idea is they are picked for a specific mission, a specific idea, to be a light unto the nations, to bring this message. But it is not saying that anybody else is better than them. That's not simply not the case. So this idea, why were they picked? Why was Abraham picked? It's right there in the name, that he stands apart. He was the man daring enough to espouse that different moral code. And that is seen up until this day, that the Jewish faith is the progenitor of also of Christianity and Islam, that they were, what was so revolutionary about them was that there was a different code. There was a different way of being. And you look at that, for example, in the laws of slavery enumerated in the Bible. And many people say, look, the Bible says that slavery, owning a slave, gives its blessing to slavery. But if you look, actually what it's saying is that it puts a term limit on slaves. You can only have a slave for 6 years, whereas at that time contemporarily, you would have a slave. You were a slave for the rest of your life. And so there is a revolutionary code in the Bible that is a different code of morality, different code of behavior. And so it is the beginning of an understanding of a different way of being that is, for its time and its place, very progressive, very revolutionary, and instilling in this an idea that there is a different way of being, because each of us, the relationship I have not just with God, but with my fellow human, has to be different, because I can no longer see you as simply a piece of property. You have the divine spark, just like I do. Therefore, when I am acting in a certain way towards you, I am diminishing the divine spark in you. And I am insulting and denigrating, in essence, God. And so that covenant that we're speaking about is not just between me and God. It's also between me and my fellow human being. So there's that double, in fact, triple relationship. It's between me and God, me and my fellow human, but also me and myself. And God is present in each of those places. And to fall down or falter in any one of those relationships is, in a way, transgressing that ultimate relationship between that me and God.
Okay. A couple of times you said God has needs, or effectively implied that God has needs. I'm trying to come to terms with this concept.
Yes. But
tell me more.
If you are sitting here with me, I mean, I'm not, I know we haven't known each other that long, Rob, and I want to be clear, I'm not specifying or implying that you're God, but for example, you are sitting in a relationship with me at the moment, albeit somewhat professional, but there are still expectations that you have for me. You cannot just be the lord of this radio channel without having some interaction with people around you. You need to have buy-in from your listeners. You need to have people contributing material, and you have to have a direction where you're going. In much the same way, this is how sometimes we picture or want to imagine God is not an aloof leader or ruler who has no interaction with the world that God has created. There is a desire, a want from God to want to be a part of our everyday life. Now, how we picture that and how we see that is very much open to interpretation. But the idea is that God wants to interact with us, to be with us, to guide us, to help us.
And that you find that in the Torah, the early books of the
books and later rabbinic writing as well, that we are all subject to, I'm not sure if subject is the right word, but we are in that relationship with God. Now, how much we want to be and how much we choose to interact there, that part is up to us. But from a very, very young age, we are brought into this covenant. At 8 days old, we circumcise our children, our boys, as a physical marker of that covenant that we live in.
Because that's a repeat of the original...
Correct. The original circumcision from Abraham and God early on in Genesis, that it is a physical mark of the covenant. And as human beings, we don't always deal very well with abstract thought. We need a physical reminder for something, right? Much the same way that why some people in certain professions wear a uniform. Because it's not enough just to know that they are that position. We need to see a physical reminder of that, a manifestation, a physical manifestation. Country flags or the clergy wearing the collar, for example. There are certain things that we need a physical reminder of. And this physical reminder of the covenant is something that we have been doing for 3,000-4,000 years. It is a reminder that you are destined and have a specific purpose and function, and you are in a very special holy relationship with the Almighty. And that also implies God is in that relationship with you.
Okay, that puts a lot of responsibility on the human side of that relationship, doesn't it? Because the human being can't just sit there and say, well, I am born this way and I carry on, I'm fine.
Correct. And that is part of the identity, I suppose, of Judaism. It is not a religion of faith. I suppose, put bluntly, when I talk to people who question this, I tell them, I'm not really so interested in what you believe. I'm really interested in what you do. And the analogy here, again, is I use as a dating relationship. When you first come into a relationship with somebody, you don't immediately decide that you're in love with this person. How does that happen? You go on dates, you buy them flowers, you take them out to dinner, and you develop those emotional feelings, that belief of the relationship based on what you do. You can't simply decide to love somebody. You need to build that based on some action, some behavior. And so for Judaism, that's part of the reason why it's so dependent on rituals, these actions that define your being. The belief comes later. There is a very famous line in the Bible that says, after the covenant and the laws have been given, where the people accept it, and they say in the Hebrew, na'aseh v'nishma, and it literally translated means, we will do, and then we will understand. You can't, pedagogically speaking, you talk to any teacher as well, you can try and explain an abstract concept or an idea, but you need to actually do it. Put another way, you want to teach your child how to swim. Are you going to simply talk to them about swimming, or are you going to take them to the pool and put them in the pool and teach them how to swim? Then they will understand what swimming is all about. But simply talking to them about swimming, simply saying you want to be in love with somebody, it doesn't give you the real essence, the real feeling of being in a relationship. It's only when you are doing those things, spending time with them, becoming invested in them, building those expectations, understanding the obligations and responsibilities you have towards a loved one, towards your child, towards God, can you really then say, I have faith in this, I believe in this. But simply uttering those words in a vacuum, from a Jewish perspective, is putting the horse before the cart. You can't do it that way. It needs to be the actions will define your beliefs and your faith, not the other way around.
Okay. But you have the slight difference from most people's understanding of Christianity in the sense that you are born a Jew, and not everybody believes you can be born a Christian.
Correct.
As a child.
Correct.
You have the children then, you will influence those children. You were talking about the swimming lessons and so on. Can I use the word inculcate?
Yeah.
An aggressive word. I don't mean that. But you make sure that the child experiences Judaism.
Correct.
In the family.
In the home, in the community, in the synagogue, with their friends and families. Absolutely.
Even though at an early age they won't know what on earth's going on.
Correct. They might not fully understand it, but again, that's because indoctrinate or educate those actions that become routine, that become habit, that will define their belief, that this is normal practice, right? We use many ways we define ourselves in the different flavors of Judaism by their practice, how much they observe and how little they observe, not little, but how they observe. It is really – that is the basis of our relationship with God. It's based on those commandments that we have to fulfill. Later on, you will develop that faith, that relationship, that deep understanding with God's presence and the holiness that comes with that. But it is based on your actions, what you do that defines you.
Okay. So Judaism is by nature exclusive because you're born a Jew. But
you can also convert to be a Jew.
Okay.
We are fully welcoming of people who choose this kind of lifestyle. But from the very outset, we make it clear that there are certain obligations and responsibilities that are incumbent on assuming that identity. And it's interesting because that's not really words that are well-liked, I suppose, or well-used in a Western society. Most of the words we're used to hearing are my rights and my privileges. But when you use words like obligations and responsibilities, sometimes you get a very glassy-eyed look from some people. And it's also slightly – or very different, I suppose, in that it's also puts a premium on community, not the individual. Given a choice between the individual and a community, almost exclusively the community will come first. The needs of the community will come before the needs of the individual. And you see that, for example, in mourning rituals, that the community is celebrating even though you've suffered a loss. But if it's a communal festival, the needs of the community will supersede that, and the rituals of private mourning are suspended until after the festival is over, which in our society will seem very archaic or very uncomfortable. What do you mean the individual isn't being respected? But you're looking at it through the wrong lens. It's for us, the community always takes precedence over the individual.
It's quite a high set of expectations built in there, isn't it?
It is. It is a high set of expectations. And I think that is part of the enduring nature of it, that people I have found cling more seriously to something that demands something of them. That's why that relationship with God is so lasting and enduring, because it is not simply do what I say because I said so. It is, I'm in this with you. I'm in this relationship with you. You do this for me and I'm going to do this for you. And when you challenge people, when you push people, they develop and go above and beyond what you might have expected of them. And I think that is maybe one of the secrets there, that there is – it is challenging. But given the choice, I think most people – and I'm not talking about simply religion at this point, but given a choice, people will tend to cling towards something that's very well clearly articulated and defined rather than something that's a little bit hazy.
Fine. Thank you very much for today. We'll come back next time to the Jewish festivals.